US weekly jobless claims jumped to a three-month high amid new shutdowns due to a surge in coronavirus pandemic. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson says there's a strong possibility Britain will fail to broker a trade deal with the EU as talks remain deadlocked with the bloc. Also ahead, Palestinian groups strongly condemn a decision by Morocco to normalize relations with Israel. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, newly released government data show nearly 1.4 million Americans applied for unemployment benefits last week. The number was far higher than economists had expected and is the biggest since the end of March during the early days of the coronavirus pandemic. 19 million workers are now getting some form of governmental assistance, but those benefits could stop by the end of the year. Congress has been deadlocked for months over passing a spending bill that includes a new federal relief package to help families and businesses hit by the pandemic. Colin Campbell says there has been a collapse in the employment system in the US due to the coronavirus lockdowns and the insecurity caused by transition to a new administration.
A shocking surge of numbers where some people believed that the economy would have improved at least a slight better than it had been throughout the summer, especially since there were ways that people could have protected themselves from COVID, and we knew just the implications of how serious the virus was. Economists believe that with the proper measures, that there would be still people holding on to their jobs and the economy would still be a little bit more robust than it is right now. However, because of the lockdowns, because of the insecurity, because of one administration transferring into another administration, there's been a hemorrhaging of jobs in the country. People are suffering. People are not able to spend as much. People are not traveling as much. Schools have been truncated as far as their activities are concerned. A lot of the impact that has been created by COVID-19 has gone well beyond some of the expectations that people predicted throughout the year. And this is the manifestation of what we're witnessing now, with more than a million people affected by this in the past week alone, and it's expected that another several hundred thousand people will be affected the week after that. This is not something to be taken lightly. This is not something that economists are taking lightly. But if you look at the White House, for example, this is not one of the big conversations coming from the White House. This is going to have to be a problem for the next administration coming in January.
Elsewhere, hundreds of Hondurans have formed a caravan to seek asylum in the United States after they lost their homes in hurricanes.
We are heading to the United States because we have lost everything. On behalf of all migrants, we ask the new president of the United States to help us. We can't live here anymore. We were going to wake up at the bus terminal, but we had to leave. We would be resting right now, and we had to go. Just imagine how risky it is to walk at night.
Migrants from the northern city of San Pedro Sula went on foot for the Guatemalan border after calls went out on social media to organize a caravan to the U.S. Guatemala's migration authorities warned the approaching migrants that they would need negative coronavirus tests and passports to enter the country. Last month, hurricanes Eta and Iota destroyed infrastructure, homes and crops and killed some 100 people in Honduras. The caravan aims to reach the U.S. despite the American government enforcing a zero-tolerance policy towards immigrants under the Donald Trump administration. The European Union unveils no-deal Brexit contingency plans amid growing fears that the bloc and Britain might fail to agree on a trade deal by the end of the year. The European Commission's president published the proposed measures in a statement on Twitter. The plans include the continuation of road and air travel between the EU and the UK for 6 months in case of a no-deal Brexit. The bloc has also proposed the possibility of reciprocal fishing access to each other's waters for a year or until an agreement is reached. Meanwhile, Ireland's foreign minister said there is still a very wide gap between the EU and Britain over the post-Brexit trade deal. Simon Coveney urged the British government to reframe the arguments that they have been making to themselves on sovereignty.
Government leaders meeting in Brussels have adopted proposals aimed at trying to avert chaos at EU-UK borders in the event that Britain abruptly exits the bloc's rules and regulations at the end of this month when the Brexit transition period ends on the 31st of December. This as floundering trade talks between both sides continue.
No one understates the challenges that lie ahead, but it's important for the citizens of Europe that we do everything we possibly can to get agreement here.
France has made it clear it will veto any EU-UK trade agreement that does not safeguard the livelihoods of those involved in the French fishing industry. The big sticking point for Germany is ensuring that British firms do not have unfair advantage over EU firms, for example, via state subsidies. Hardline Brexiteers do not want to see a deal as they are worried this would align the UK too closely to the EU. Equally, there are many people in the European Union who adjudge London to be extremely arrogant. This cohort does not want to see a deal as they'd rather look on as Britain faces the full consequences of Brexit. Those consequences might include very restricted travel to the EU from the UK from January the 1st due to the 27-nation bloc's COVID-19 rules with respect to non-members. British citizens living in the EU would likely face all sorts of bureaucracy. Then, of course, there are warnings of dire economic consequences for the UK and possibly Scottish independence. We are told the key to securing a EU-UK future relationship agreement to avoid chaos in January is fairness.
This fine balance of fairness has not been achieved so far. Our negotiators are still working and we will take a decision on Sunday.
Even in the absence of a trade deal with the UK, EU leaders know they already face many economic challenges.
We still haven't fully resolved the problems of very high public debt, private debt still very high, banking sector problems still very present, price adjustments still ongoing.
The prospects aren't looking good. As EU leaders continued their meeting in the Belgian capital, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson stated there is a, quote, strong possibility a trade deal will not be reached. Jerome Hughes, outside the European Council, Brussels.
And the European Union has threatened Ankara with fresh sanctions amid Turkey's row with Greece and Cyprus over potential gas resources in the eastern Mediterranean. However, Turkey says it will not bow down to threats and blackmail.
EU leaders told Turkey in October to stop exploring in the contested eastern Mediterranean waters or face consequences. Earlier this week, all EU states agreed that in their view, Turkey has made no positive shift away from its policy of exploring in contested waters and upped its threat of sanctions. Ankara urged the EU to act with common sense to solve the dispute. But ahead of Thursday's EU summit, Turkey's president made his stance very clear.
Any sanctions decision that can be taken against Turkey will not concern Turkey much. Since 1963, the EU is officially constantly imposing sanctions on us anyway. The EU has never acted honestly.
Germany, the current holder of the EU's six-month presidency, holds the key to whether sanctions will go ahead. However, Turkey resuming its gas exploration off Cyprus in October has angered Berlin.
In recent months, Germany has made an extraordinary effort to find a way to intensify the dialogue between Turkey and the European Union. Regrettably, tensions between Turkey, Cyprus and Greece have not allowed direct talks to begin, and there have been far too many provocations.
Turkey's row with Greece and Cyprus over the extent of their continental shelves in the East Mediterranean flared up in August when Turkey sent a survey vessel to waters claimed by Greece. The two European nations accuse Ankara of drilling for hydrocarbons off its continental shelf. Turkey pulled the vessel out in September to allow for diplomacy with Greece, but then sent it back to the area, prompting an angry reaction from Greece, France and Germany. However, Ankara seems unfazed.
On the Eastern Mediterranean, we will continue to protect our rights. Moreover, we will continue to protect the rights of Northern Cyprus until the end. It is never possible for us to compromise here. But if Greece really acts honestly as a neighbour, we will continue to be available at the table.
The EU created a sanctions programme last year to punish what it calls unauthorised exploration in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea, freezing assets of people and companies accused of planning or participating in activities in Cyprus's exclusive economic zone or on its continental shelf. Only senior officials of Turkey's state-owned Turkish Petroleum Corporation were put on the sanctions list, but that was not enough for Greece. It is a delicate situation for Germany, having to mediate between two NATO members, Ankara and Athens, without seeming to have divided loyalties. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And in other news, Morocco's decision to normalize ties with Israel has been met with fierce condemnation by Islamic groups and factions. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas called the move a political sin, which emboldens the Israeli regime in its crimes against the Palestinians. The Islamic Jihad movement also condemned the decision as a betrayal to the Islamic and Arab world. Yemen's Ansar Allah movement also noted that there isn't any justification for Arab states to establish ties with Israel. The reactions follow U.S. President Donald Trump's announcement that Morocco has become the fourth Arab country to normalize its ties with the regime, after Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Sudan over the past months. In return, Trump said Washington recognized Morocco's sovereignty over the entire Western Sahara. Political commentator Ali Farage says the U.S. brokered normalization deal between Israeli regime and Morocco will make Tel Aviv more brazen in violating the rights of the Palestinians.
Obviously now, the announcement of the relationship, normalization of the relationship, is not helping any peace process in Middle East, because the Zionist regime has been occupying more and more Palestinian lands and keeping Gaza Strip and siege, obviously violating all sorts of human rights. It's an apartheid regime, and people who stand by such regime, like they stand by the regime in South Africa before, they were definitely at the wrong side of humanity and is not supporting any sort of ethical movement or support for Palestinian rights. If there were no ties before and the Zionist regime didn't admit to the Palestinian rights, including the right for a Palestinian state, how would they do that now? If the relationships are being normalized, the Palestinians themselves see this as a stab at the back and is not supporting the peace process, is not supporting the end of occupation, is not supporting other than starting new wars.
Meanwhile, the UN Human Rights Office has expressed alarm at the prosecution of a Saudi woman rights defender in a terrorism court, saying she has been detained on, quote, spurious charges. In a statement, the UN office said Lujain al-Hathloul is being tried by the Specialized Criminal Court for exercising her fundamental rights to freedom of expression and peaceful assembly. The UN called on Saudi Arabia to immediately release the rights activist who was detained more than 2 years ago for defying the ban on women driving in Saudi Arabia. Riyadh later lifted the ban. Hathloul's family said she appeared before the terrorism court on Thursday as she faces the prospect of a lengthy prison sentence. The hearing comes at a time that Saudi Arabia faces growing international criticism for its human rights record. The United States Senate has approved a massive arms sale to the United Arab Emirates. The legislation has been passed despite Abu Dhabi's strong role in the years-long war on Yemen and its controversial military interferences in the region.
The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump is given the go-ahead to sell billions of dollars worth of arms to the UAE. On Wednesday, the Republican-led U.S. Senate approved the deal proposed by the government. The contract, reportedly worth some $23 billion, includes the sales of the U.S.'s most advanced F-35 fighter jets and Reaper drones. Senators voted almost along party lines on two resolutions. All but two Democrats voted to block the deal, while one Republican broke ranks to vote against the sale. Trump had issued a formal threat to veto congressional efforts to block the weapons transfer. Those in favor of the deal described the UAE as an important U.S. partner in West Asia. Detractors, on the other hand, argued the UAE should not be armed with advanced weapons given its involvement in the war on Yemen. They also warned that such a move would ignite an arms race in the region. A couple of months ago, in a controversial move, the UAE normalized its relations with Israel. The country trampled upon years of at least verbal commitment to the Palestinian cause by recognizing Israel. It also distanced itself from the majority of the Arab countries that have no diplomatic relations with Israel over the regime's occupation of Palestinian lands. The UAE's recognition of Israel was said to be a precondition for its purchase of advanced weaponry from the United States. Therefore, F-35 jets and Reaper drones can be considered the payoff for turning their back to Palestinians. The United Arab Emirates, which is ruled by monarchs, has a bleak human rights record. The country is a staunch Saudi ally, the two of which have been leading a devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. The war has killed thousands of innocent Yemenis, including women and children, and has caused what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UAE also openly supported anti-government militants in Syria, exacerbating the suffering of the Syrian people by fueling the bloodshed in the Arab country. It has also been actively engaged in the brutal suppression of a popular pro-democracy movement in neighboring Bahrain. Abu Dhabi is now eyeing to seize control of southern Yemen, including a strategic island there, using its proxies.
A mega transportation project is launched in Iran's northeast. The project can link Iran's eastern neighbors to the north-south corridor and the country's ports. Here's a report by Human Abidi.
Iran and Afghanistan have launched a railway that connects the Iranian northeastern city of Khaf to Herat in the other country. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani and his Afghan counterpart Ashraf Ghani attended the inauguration ceremony through video conference due to the global corona epidemic. The two sides said the project is a pivotal one that helps boost bilateral economic ties and collaborations.
With the completion of such an important project, the commodities of your businessmen could easily be transferred to Europe. With this railway, you can have access to Iran's southern ports, including Imam Khomeini Port and Bandar Abbas, and later on to Chabahar.
For his part, the Afghan president also said that the important project will give fresh momentum to economic ties between the two countries.
We jointly put iron on earth and soil to tie the destiny of the two nations to outline our future collaborations. I offer congratulations and wish the best for the two nations and governments.
The railway is about 140 kilometers long, and after being connected to Herat, it will be about 225 kilometers.
The Khaf-Herat Railway will enhance economic, cultural, and social exchanges between the two countries. It will see over 6 million tons of goods transported annually. It will also link Afghanistan through Iran to the Caspian Sea, Russia, and Europe. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. all produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A report by Brown University Watson Institute's CAS AWAR project, one of the premier authorities on civilian casualties in the 19-year so-called War on Terror, found a 330% increase in the number of Afghan civilians killed by U.S.-led airstrikes from 2016, the final year of the Obama administration, to 2019. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading Report Blames Trump Administration for 330% Rise in Afghan Civilian Casualties. Here's the details. The Trump administration's 2017 decision to loosen military rules of engagement meant to protect civilians was followed by a sharp increase in civilian deaths, a report released on Monday, December 7th, revealed. The report by Nita C. Crawford of the Brown University Watson Institute's CAS AWAR project, one of the premier authorities on civilian casualties in the 19-year so-called War on Terror, found a 330% increase in the number of Afghan civilians killed by the U.S.-led airstrikes from 2016, the final year of the Obama administration, to 2019. From 2007 to 2016, U.S.-led forces killed an average of 582 civilians each year, the report found. From 2017 through 2019, those same forces killed an average of 1,134 civilians each year, a nearly 95% increase. The sharp uptick in civilian deaths followed a decision by President Donald Trump, in consultation with former Defense Secretary James Mattis and other military and civilian officials, to relax rules of engagement in the Afghan war in order to give U.S. commanders more battlefield flexibility and to gain leverage at the bargaining table with the Taliban, as both sides sought to end the devastating war whose course has spanned nearly the entire 21st century. From 2017 through 2019, civilian deaths due to U.S. and allied forces' airstrikes in Afghanistan dramatically increased, the report states. In 2019, airstrikes killed 700 civilians, more civilians than in any other year since the beginning of the war in 2001 and 2002. After the U.S. and Taliban reached a peace agreement in late February 2020, U.S. and other international airstrikes declined, and so did the harm to civilians caused by those strikes. According to the United Nations, U.S.-led airstrikes killed more civilians than did Taliban militant attacks during the first half of 2019. The report also underscores the fact that a reduction or even total withdrawal of U.S. ground combat troops does not mean an end to war or civilian casualties, as most American combat is one-sided and takes place in the air. Crawford cites U.S. General Lance R. Bunch, who said in June 2018 that the entire purpose behind air campaign is to pressure the Taliban into reconciliation and to help them realize that peace talks are their best option, a policy that has drawn comparisons to the Nixon administration's so-called Christmas bombing campaign against
Hanoi, or other North Vietnamese cities in December 1972 during the closing weeks of the Paris peace talks. Consequently, the report states that there were more weapons dropped from the air in 2019 and 2018 than at the height of U.S. presence in Afghanistan in 2011. Although there are still 43 days left in his presidency, it is possible that Trump will leave office being able to boast that he was the first president since Jimmy Carter to not start a new war. However, during his administration, civilian casualties have increased in nearly all of at least seven countries under the U.S. attack in the War on Terror. Much of the increase has been attributed to Trump's loosening of rules of engagement. While campaigning for president, Trump suggested using nuclear weapons in Afghanistan might result in a quick U.S. victory, while considering the possibility that tens of millions of people would be killed. According to the Cost of War Project, more than 43,000 Afghan civilians have been killed during the 18-year U.S.-led so-called War on Terror. Taliban militants have killed the most non-combatants, but thousands of men, women, and children have also been killed by the United States and its allied forces during bombs and airstrikes and bullets. In the wider war against terrorism, estimates of civilian death caused by U.S.-led forces range from around 1 million to as many as 2 million.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and let us reflect on what the Prophet's divinely designated heir, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, has said about prosperity in life and salvation in the afterlife. Charity is an effective cure, and the actions of people in their present life will be before their eyes in the next life.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam Al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام لا ذل كذل الطمع.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "There is no disgrace worse than that of greed."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In these beautiful dialogues which we find regarding Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth divinely appointed imam in the Ahl al-Bayt, we find that there is a very long but interesting and profound dialogue between one of the students of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam by the name of Jabir bin Yazid al-Ju'fi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam himself. So this dialogue is a dialogue between the teacher and the student. In this dialogue, we find that Imam Baqir alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, puts forth some very immortal commandments and statements full of quite high moral standards and ideals. And truly, even though this is a simple conversation,
But if the standards and ideals are implemented and put into effect, surely a human being can attain the heights of perfection. One of the statements that we find in this conversation between Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is when the Imam says, "Remain wary of Iblis through the tearful fear of Allah. Beware of the false hope, for it throws into the truthful fear. Adorn yourself for Allah, the Great and Almighty, through honesty in your actions, and show love to Allah through the quick change." In this part of this long dialogue, which we have been discussing, we find that first and foremost, Imam Baqir, peace and blessings upon him, says to be careful of shaitan by having fear of Allah. Now here, when we talk about fear of Allah, we mean the fear of disobeying Allah, of breaking Allah's commandments, of making Allah angry at us for being disobedient, and not involuntary disobedience, which sometimes happens, and we can ask forgiveness for that as well, but voluntary disobedience, in your face disobedience. We should be fearful of this. We should also be careful of false hopes and long materialistic desires, false hopes in the materialistic world. Oh, one day I'm going to be a bazillionaire. Because Imam al-Baqir says this throws a person into truthful fear when one is careful of their false hopes. Finally, Imam al-Baqir says that we should adorn ourselves, beautify ourselves by having honesty and sincerity in our actions. Very beautiful points to ponder in this dialogue between Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now let's listen to Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, who's going to talk about today's topic.
And so I would like to talk a little bit about the historical conditions that surrounded this great imam and see what lessons we can learn from him and in the struggles that he had to face. And so the imam concentrated his efforts on the intellectual development of the Muslim Ummah. The Muslim Ummah in general and the Shia community in particular. And this is something that I think we could learn from the imams. For example, the idea of coinage was something that the imam had suggested to the caliph for him to do. Before that, they were using the old coins based upon the old empires, the old Byzantine and Sassanid empires. He was behaving the same way like Imam Ali alayhi salam, insofar as the knowledge and advice is not something that you restrict to just people who follow you or people who agree with you or people who you like. But knowledge and advice is something that is open for all. It doesn't mean to say that you support them in what they do, but you will be helping them in doing good, in doing that which is best. The imams are teaching us that in a time where the overwhelming power is in the hands, the overwhelming military power and economic power is in the hands of those people who are inimical of truth and justice, that the best thing to do is not necessarily to rise up. You rise up only when you have the right organization, when you have the right strategy, when you have the right politics, when you have the right people who have the right foresight to be able to know what to do. That's when you rise up. In the meantime, what you do is you increase yourself in knowledge. What you do is you impart that knowledge to others. What you do is you offer a helping hand. What you do is you advise others where they ask you for advice. And in this way, you build up a movement which, after a long time in history, its time will come to pass where it will be able to rise up and create a just system. Give salawat to the Holy Prophet Muhammad and his family.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
It didn't take long before Mohammed bin Salman initiated a ruthless and relentless campaign to eliminate his rivals and critics, inside the royal court, inside the country, in the region, or beyond. The Khashoggi case that sparked international outrage was no aberration, but only the tip of the iceberg. Over the past few years, bin Salman's men have made attempts to pave his way to the throne, by abducting, arresting, detaining, and even killing Saudi citizens who think the young prince is not the best choice as the next king. Bin Salman's main targets have turned out to be rights activists, political dissidents, prominent businessmen, and influential royals. Those languishing behind bars are the luckiest ones, in comparison to those already dead or still unaccounted for. The exact number of the victims is not clear due to the secret nature of the elimination campaign, but a review of the known part of the story would illustrate the gravity of the situation. In the March palace purge, at least 20 princes were rounded up on bin Salman's orders. The most prominent ones still in detention are Prince Mohammed bin Saad bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, a member of the Bayah, or Allegiance Council, which decides the succession of the Saudi throne, Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, the former Crown Prince and Interior Minister, and Prince Ahmed bin Abdulaziz, the son of Abdulaziz, Saudi Arabia's founder and first ruler. Ahmed had returned to the kingdom from London in late 2018 to block bin Salman's ascension to the throne, but ended up behind bars.
Well, I think he feels the need to make them afraid of himself, because he does feel those closest to him in power, because that is who could replace him. So you can see by his behavior that he is afraid, whether he ought to be or not, that's his perception. And so he's often pulling stunts to try and put those under him in line and to make sure that they fear him as a means of control.
The largest purge under bin Salman happened here at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in November 2017, where over 350 royals, officials, and businessmen were locked up. Prominent among them were Prince Mitab bin Abdullah, the son of the late King Abdullah. He was released later that month after reportedly paying more than $1 billion to the Crown Prince. And Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, one of the richest men on the planet. He was released in January 2018 after having reportedly reached a financial settlement with the royal court.
These are very powerful businessmen. These are fellow princes, and he essentially had them quarantined in a hotel. Nobody can do that other than a crown prince, and so he's flexing his power because he feels like he needs to so that threats in the future will be given credibility. If he's willing to do something that seemingly seems this insane, the next time he makes a threat, everyone's going to listen because he had no bounds and he got away with it. After pulling such a stunt, nothing happened. There's a little bit of bad PR, but what he feels he gained in fear outweighed any of the consequences, of which there were very little.
Putting the royals in jail or under house arrest was an unmistakable signal that no one was safe in the kingdom, including an untold number of former officials and business people like Khalid al-Tawajri, the former chief of the Saudi royal court, Amr al-Dabbah, the former Saudi Arabian General Investment Authority head, Mohammed Hussein al-Amoudi, a Saudi-Ethiopian dual citizen and a major investor, and Dr. Walid Fatahi, a popular reformist.
This isn't the rulings of an honest monarch or of any republic or any sort of leadership. This is a totalitarian regime that uses insane punishments, death, assassinations, kidnapping, any means, as if the mafia or a criminal gang were in charge of the government, because he behaves in the same way as the lowest dregs of society that would be in jail were he not the crown prince.
Right now, there are many Saudi citizens, mainly former high-ranking officials, who have gone into exile to escape imprisonment and death. Saad al-Jabri, a former intelligence official and Prince Mohammed bin Nayef's right-hand man, is a case in point. Jabri fled Saudi Arabia to Canada in 2017 before being caught in the power struggle in the palace. His life has been under constant threat by bin Salman's hitmen. Almost 1 year before the murder of Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in September 2017, in a separate purge that threw more than 60 people in jail, religious scholars like Sheikh Salman al-Oda, Awad al-Qarni, and Ali al-Omari were arrested. Saudi prosecutors have asked for death sentences for them as the sympathizers of the Muslim Brotherhood-inspired Shua movement. The arrest of more than a dozen women's rights activists, including Lujain al-Hathloul, Iman al-Nafjan, and Aziza al-Yusuf, is a well-known story. There are worrisome reports that these activists are under harrowing conditions, being subject to torture and sexual harassment.
This MBS is really dependent on what he feels his tight supporters, these Takfiri Salafist Islamic groups who do not believe women should be driving or doing many other things. But really, MBS is not a fan of any kind of civil rights or human rights whatsoever. This is someone that will assassinate on a whim. He'll kidnap people, including a prime minister, and of course the starvation and utter destruction of the people of Yemen. There is not a sympathetic bone in his body, and he feels threatened by civil rights, because as more people drive, if the entire female population or allow the same access to education and so forth, he feels that that is a threat to his position, and it undermines his extremist and fundamentalist religious views.
Besides the high-profile case of Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed in October 2018 in Istanbul by the Tiger Squad, a group of intelligence and military operatives established under Mohammed bin Salman, there are at least two other important cases. Prince Mansour bin Makrin, deputy governor of Asir province, was allegedly killed by the Tiger Squad in a helicopter crash in November 2017. Sources close to Mansour claim that he was attempting to flee the kingdom when he was killed. The other figure allegedly eliminated by the Tiger Squad is Sheikh Suleiman Abdulrahman Al-Thunya, Mecca Public Court's president, who opposed bin Salman's 2030 economic vision. It is said he was killed in a hospital in Riyadh in October 2018 by an injection.
Well, he continues to have victims because, with the exception of Khashoggi, there's very little coverage and there aren't any consequences, so he continues this maniacal behavior. He once kidnapped the Prime Minister of Lebanon for days, and this got very little media attention. Can you imagine the global media if Iran had pulled such a stunt, or even if the President of the United States had done such a thing, and yet somehow MBS gets a pass?
Almost all of the victims reviewed here belong to the political, social, and economic elite within the Saudi kingdom. The fate of dissidents outside the circle is a foregone conclusion. In all these cases, Saudi spin doctors have justified the Crown Prince's Iron Fist policy as a crackdown on corruption and as a fight for fundamental reforms. Is that so? Or as the proverb goes, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, at least in the case of the Saudi Crown Prince himself.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
According to the findings of the new study by the United Nations Development Program, UNDP, the severe long-term effects of the global pandemic could push an additional 207 million people into extreme poverty over the next decade. On top of the current pandemic trajectory, that would bring the total number of individuals living in extreme poverty to over 1 billion by 2030. This at a time of rampant and nearly unparalleled inequality as the fortunes of the world's richest individuals and families continue to soar. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading UN warns 1 billion more people headed for extreme poverty by 2030 amid pandemic. Here's the details of this article. A harrowing study released by the United Nations early on Thursday, December 3rd, reveals that the global coronavirus pandemic is setting the stage for a massive surge in the number of people pushed into poverty worldwide over the next decade, a phenomenon that only immediate interventions in the form of ambitious investments in public health, social safety net programs, and a green transition can help avoid. According to the findings of the new study by the United Nations Development Programme, UNDP, the severe long-term effects of the global pandemic could push an additional 207 million people into extreme poverty over the next decade. On top of the current pandemic trajectory, that would bring the total number of individuals living in extreme poverty to over 1 billion by 2030, this at a time of rampant and nearly unparalleled inequality as the fortunes of the world's richest individuals and families continue to soar. While the UNDP makes clear the looming intensification of poverty is not a foregone conclusion, only with urgent action can such a scenario be avoided. As this new poverty research highlights, the COVID-19 pandemic is a tipping point, and the choices leaders take now could take the world in very different directions, said UNDP Administrator Achim Steiner. The analysis considers various recovery pathways and predicts how each one would affect the UN's Sustainable Development Goals, SDGs. Under the baseline scenario, based on current mortality rates and growth projections, 44 million more people will likely be pushed into extreme poverty by 2030 than would have been expected before the COVID-19 pandemic altered the world's development trajectory. In a high-damage scenario in which the recovery is protracted, meaning that 80% of economic productivity losses remain after 10 years, 207 million additional people are projected to be living in poverty, bringing the total to 1 billion by the end of the decade. Worsening poverty is not inevitable, however. The UNDP also finds that a focused set of interventions to attain the SDGs, which the authors call the SDG push scenario, could lift 146 million people out of extreme poverty compared to the current pandemic-driven trends and reduce the gender poverty gap too. By making SDG investments over the next decade in social protection as well as digital and green economic development, we can accelerate out of this crisis, the report says, and actually exceed pre-coronavirus expectations for human development in fragile states. According to the UNDP, the benefits of a strong SDG push are echoed across additional human development indicators, including nutrition and education. With SDG interventions, the report states about 128 million adults and 16 million children are likely to escape malnutrition by 2030, and the proportion of children graduating from upper secondary school rises from the estimated 66% to 70%.